This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings from Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Second Chance: How to Make and Keep Big Money from the Coming Gold and Silver Shockwave. And joining me is one of the co-authors, David H. Smith. The other author, David Morgan, can't join us today, but David, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you, Jay.
Pleasure to visit with you. We were talking just a little bit before the recording started, and of course this is dealing with a subject matter that is kind of is over my head in many ways, even though I've invested in certain things in the stock market. Gold and silver is a hot topic. I remember back several years ago that the Hunt brothers got into trouble for running the price of silver up to a maximum limit of around $50 an ounce, if I remember correctly. Is this dealt with in your book? How do you approach the idea of investing?
Well, you know, we actually participated in that as investors when the Hunt brothers were running the price up, and that was a very small aspect. In other words, most of the people in the world weren't even paying attention or interested in it. And now we have something that's entirely different because it's a systemic issue about the issue of the financial indebtedness of the countries in the world and this type of a thing. Also, the supply-demand matrix has completely changed. And so we have a situation now which is kind of like Hunt brothers times 100, and it involves a large percentage of the people on the Earth's surface, which are going to be involved either directly now or will be due to the financial mess that we're in. So this is quite a compelling story. And in addition to it being a fear trade where people are trying to protect their own wealth, it's also the love trade because India and China have become the two largest consumers in the world of gold. They buy it as a substitute for banking and for weddings and holidays and all sorts of things. So it's a very compelling big picture story that we're looking at.
And we're looking at an attraction or a love of both of these metals for hundreds and maybe even thousands of years. Why do you think that is so? Is it because gold is so rare?
That's part of it. It's because it has the ability that nothing else has in terms of being used as money. So it's largely a money story. The silver story is a money story and an industrial metal story. But gold has been used because it's durable, because it's fungible. In other words, 1 ounce of gold is the same as another ounce of gold. You can carry it around. It's portable. It has a great deal of value that society has assigned for it in relationship to its size. For example, an ounce of gold today is worth about $1,250. You can imagine how many soybeans you'd have to carry around to be $1,200 worth of soybeans, or copper, or lead, or something like this. So gold for 6,000 years has served to be money as opposed to the paper promises. My co-author David Morgan coined this term, paper promises. This is what's in your wallet. And you go, well, yes, I have a $100 bill in my wallet, but the reality is, the $100 bill buys about what a $20 bill would buy in 1970 due to inflation and loss of purchasing power, whereas an ounce of gold not only has held its power since then, but has increased greatly.
How long have you been focused on the silver and gold markets? How long have you been studying and researching and developing your theories on this?
Well, both my co-author David Morgan and I have been involved in the markets directly since the 1970s. And we've been thinking about this book for about the last 15 years. And this is when the current gold and silver bull market got started around between 1998 and 2002. And we talked about, this approach, and we've added ideas to it, and we've become more knowledgeable about what we'd like to say. And this book was the result, which we published last winter, as a result of a lot of thinking and practicing. And my co-author, David Morgan, has his own letter, The Morgan Report, and I contribute to that on a regular basis. He speaks all over the world at conferences, and I present at conferences as well, mostly in North America. And I do mining tours. One of the people on our team that does mining tours, I'll be going down to Peru to look at a gold mining operation next month. So we are deeply involved in it. We have our own money on the line, and we've given a great deal of thinking not only to how to make but also keep big money during what we believe is going to evolve into an historic bull run for gold, silver, and the mining stocks. And we want to help people. We want to give back to what we have learned to help people to keep a lot of money and to have a better quality of life because they can help others as well with the money that they earn and not give it all back, which is what most people do when a bull run inevitably ends. And someday this will end. It's some years down the line. But trees don't grow to the sky.
Well, you've talked about tsunami in the opening remarks of your book. How does that analogy fit with gold and silver?
We use that as a metaphor throughout the book, Jay. And the metaphor that we've developed, for example, is that in 2008, and not many people realize this, but we almost came to a complete collapse of the global monetary system. It came within a few hours of collapsing as the credit and exchange seized up all around the world and very narrowly averted. And in the process, they didn't solve the problems, and we still have them now. Many of them are much bigger than they were, but they printed a lot of extra money. And so all this money has been chasing bubbles around the world, real estate and art and all sorts of things like that, and driving prices up well beyond fundamental value. And so we believe that just like a tsunami, which often has not more than one wave, that wave came in, it caused a lot of destruction, the water went back out again, and people went out on the beach just like they do in real life and said, you know, it's safe to go into the water again, and it's safe to go beachcombing. Well, we believe that another wave is forming right now, and it's heading our way, a series of waves, financial waves, that are going to sweep away a lot of the asset class values that people have. And this is not going to be the end of the world, but it's going to be a massive transfer of wealth from those people who are prepared and have taken a portion of their savings and placed it in the precious metals and miners versus those who have not done any of that. And as the value moves from one asset class to another, moving into these, people who prepared a little bit, even with a fairly minor way, will have a great opportunity to safeguard using their purchase of gold, silver, and the miners as insurance to protect some of their other assets so that they won't be wiped out.
You have mentioned two big players in this area, China being one and India being the second. China has been also described in your book as the new Silk Road. What was the importance of the Silk Road and how does it impact our world today?
Historically, the Silk Road was the method of land trading, primarily land, to from Asia, from Far Asia, China, Mongolia, to through into Europe and through the Middle East. And these were actual routes that people, caravans went with camels, and they brought spices and all sorts of things to Europe, and Europe traded things back into Asia. And so today, it's called the New Silk Road. China is primarily country that's involved with this, but it's involved Russia and India as well, too, and all the countries in between. But their idea is to build it's called One Belt and Road. The belt is the land traverse of using high-speed rail and improved freeways and this type of a thing, and it would go all the way from Beijing right into Spain and actually into England now that they have the
really?
Channel that they can go take a train underneath the English Channel. And then the road, is the maritime portion of which trading, you know, through the South China Sea out into Iran and out into the Middle East and out into India that way. And it's a massive, massive economic developmental zone. It has its own monetary basis. So, you know, still the U.S. dollar is still the reserve currency of the world, but the Chinese are putting up their own parallel financial system to compete with the U.S. SWIFT system for monetary transfer and this type of a thing. And it encompasses between a third and almost a half of the world's population. And it's going to be a complete economic system unto itself, which would be nice if they want to trade with us, but they wouldn't have to. And so it's a really, really big deal. And we talk about this in the introduction to give people an idea of the really, really big picture that's involved with this.
You have 260 pages, a lot of phenomenal information in here. But as a sideline investor, as I am, or one that's curious about gold and silver, I notice a lot of advertising on television that suggests we actually own gold in our portfolio. Is that something that you advise, or is there a different approach? You have maybe four or five success secrets that you have unveiled in your book. What would you suggest to the investor?
We recommend that people own some physical gold and silver first, because they have claim to it, and that's the thing. There's no other asset class that has no claim to it. If you or I have gold in our hand, it's ours. In other words, I'm not responsible for fulfilling my responsibility to you to give you the gold. If you've already got it, that's it. But if I have a contract for gold or if it's a contract for real estate or anything else, there's a claim on that, and somebody has to fulfill that as a contractual party in order for me to have it. And so if I hold an ETF with gold in it, or if I hold even a mining stock, I don't have the gold itself. So we recommend as an insurance policy a small amount of physical gold, and we discuss how to get that and not be taken to the cleaners by unscrupulous sellers. Then after you do that, we mentioned how the metals themselves have a certain leverage to the price. They pretty much move in lockstep to the world price, but the mining stocks can move up 5, 10, 15, or even 20 times more on a percentage basis than the metal itself, due to the fact that some of these deposits are very rich and very profitable. And so this is where the really big money is for people that want to accept a little bit more calculated risk and do it in a way that accords with their own financial circumstances and risk reward ability and things like this. And that's why we set up a four-step investment profit process whereby people can determine what should be done and then go about it and put the plan together and then activate that plan.
And that includes ways to keep your investments and keep your financial success. Is that correct?
Exactly, because you have to do, if it's going to work for you or me or anybody else, it has to be in accord with human nature. You have to deal with the fear and greed elements in the market. And a lot of people talk about how to make the money and not many about how to keep it. But if they go against human nature, it's not going to work for you. So we have put together a specific way to approach this that will deal with fear and greed, and it will accord with it and also with the realities of the market, rather than to try to go against your own nature.
And you have used a four-step decision-making model that should be adaptable or understood by most anyone that reads your book.
It really is. And you go about looking at things. You look at the big picture, the observe, and you pay attention to what's going on. Then you ask yourself, how do I fit into this picture, my temperament, my financial circumstances, my ability to handle risk? And then that's the orient part. And then you decide, you come up with a plan. And we talked very specifically about how to put together a plan that works for you. And then finally, you act on that plan. A lot of people do the first couple or three steps, sometimes only two of them, and then they never get around to the last step. So if you just watch and you never act, then you're going to be part of the crowd rather than part of what's going on. And we want you to become involved in what's going on for your own benefit.
Your book just gives guidance on how not only to make money, but also to keep your big money during the coming gold and silver shockwave, which you anticipate is on the horizon, correct?
Right. It's evolving as we speak. And the thing is, people expect things to move in a linear fashion. In other words, you go, well, gold's $1,200 today, and if it goes to $1,300, I'll buy something. But things, as we evolve in this, it's not going to be just linear. It's not going to be 12, 13, 14, 15, where it's predictable. It may be at 14 or 15, and you might wake up the next day, and it might be 2,200. And so it can go on an exponential basis, and that's what will happen near the end of the run, and that's where the massive profits are. My co-author David Morgan has stated this many times in his talks and different conferences around the world, and he has shown conclusively that 80 to 90% of the entire profit potential of the bull run move occurs during the last 10% of the time that the whole bull run has been involved. So people haven't missed out. That's what we talk about, the second chance. If you weren't involved when silver went to 50 in 2011, you've still got a second chance to get in, and we are still not anyways near that last 10% in the time of the move. And if you're positioned by then or before then, the profits that you have, the potential could be absolutely life-changing.
This is one of the few books that I have seen that deals with the mining stocks as well. And is this maybe the key to your book that makes it a little bit different from others in the marketplace?
It really is. And we talk about the decision-making process of how we choose stocks to put in the asset allocation tables in the Morgan Report. And we discuss, you know, what we look for on the ground and what we look for in looking at the financial statements and this type of a thing. So we give people a real good grounding. And, you know, it's a type of book, and we've had many reviews of the book, all been very, very complimentary of people who've never picked up a gold coin before or traded a mining stock, and other people who manage mining operations worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And they've been very complimentary about it. And the thing is, you don't have to be an expert to understand what we're saying, but at the same time, if you are highly experienced in the sector, you will still find much of value. So it's something that appeals to people of all different levels. And you know, Jay, there's something else too. In the last chapter we did intentionally on this is chapter 12, we deal with the millennials and the baby boomers in terms of the two categories that are can benefit so much from this. You know, we're boomers ourselves. We've raised each raised two millennials ourselves. And we want to give back to that group of people because they're the ones that are going to be taking over when the boomers step off the stage.
Right.
And, you know, the millennial, I didn't even realize this until just before we published the book, but it is the largest American generation in history. It's 8 or 9 million larger in terms of total population than the baby boomers themselves, which are a record generation. So you can imagine the massive effect that their decision making is going to have through their lifespan on the course of American history.
Fascinating book. The title again is Second Chance, How to Make and Keep Big Money from the Coming Gold and Silver Shock Wave. Co-authors David H. Smith and David Morgan. David H. Smith has joined me today. David, where do I get a copy of your book?
You can buy it through, we have, if you go to the Morgan Report, .com. We have a link there. You can also go direct to lulu.com, L-U-L-U, which are the publishers of our book. It's available on Amazon as well, too. And it's available in softcover, in hardback, or in ebook. And you know, Jay, one thing I'd like to mention, which I think is really important, and it's kind of like a leitmotif throughout our book, we're not talking about just how to get a bunch of money and keep it all for yourself,
right,
and that type of a thing, and be greedy and never have enough. Like Henry Ford once said, they said, ask him how much is enough, and he said just a little bit more. We don't look at things like that, and we give examples through the book, through our own experience and through people we've met, about people and ways to live a good life where you can do well for yourself by making a lot of money, and you can do good for other people, your family members, your friends, people that you run into that you feel are especially deserving. And this giving back and this gratitude and expressing gratitude for what we have, this is what makes a life rich and rewarding. And one of the people that we profile in the book is a man named Jim Tinney, and he was the inventor of the Tinney nymph, which has caught more fish, salt and freshwater fish records, than any other fly pattern ever tied. And I know him personally, and he's a wonderful man. And to me, he exemplifies, and we profile his life in our book, the type of person that I feel is such a decent person and a deserving person. And this is the type of person that I strive to be in my own life, and I know David Morgan is this way. He's one of the finest men I've ever met, and personally and professionally. But this is how you come out of it, by doing well for yourself and then being able to do good for others so that you live a quality life on this finite time that we have on this planet.
Absolutely great advice and a wonderful observation. I am wholeheartedly behind your statement of giving back. I think that is where life begins, as you give. So thank you for sharing your story and your inspiration as well. The title of the book again is Second Chance, How to Make and Keep Big Money from the Coming Gold and Silver Shockwave that's on the horizon. David H. Smith has been my guest. David, thank you again for sharing your story.
And thank you, Jay, and have a great day.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press, this is Jay Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff. And find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Despite Fear, A Visceral Plight. And the author is Zenko Case, and Zenko joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Lulu Publishing. Hello, Zenko.
Hello.
Great to have you with us. Now, your book, Despite Fear, is really your story, and you've had a lot of challenges, and you say, you found your way through these challenges, not as a victim, which a lot of people feel they are, but as an intact soul. So we're going to talk about how you've journeyed through all these challenges, and of course you want to inspire people to recover and resolve, because everybody goes through pain, right?
Right, exactly. That's life.
That is life, and you have had plenty of pain.
Well, it's sort of built into a volcano, yes.
You know,
apparently.
Even to the point where you almost were shot to death.
Yes, yes. I was at death's door, you might say, at the edge of life.
Right. So as you look back, and this book is more of your memoirs, right? It's taken from your journal.
Yes. Yes, journal, and I filled in some backstory, and so it's pretty much my inside story.
Your inside story, and it starts out when you're about how old, what, 18?
Well, I go back to 6 or 7 years old, but okay. I first got married 2 weeks after my 18th birthday.
2 weeks after your 18th birthday, a lot of folks at that age maybe don't quite know what they're doing.
No, they just want to get out and on with their whatever their life is going to be.
Right.
So they don't have a clue.
Don't have a clue. So
nor did I.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to focus a whole lot on all the pain. We really want to help people understand how to get through the pain, but we need to kind of set the record straight. So how many marriages did you have?
I was married 4 times.
And how many
took
children?
3 to get to the good to the pot of gold.
Okay, so it took 3 to get to
the good
one. And how many children do you have?
I have 4 children.
4 children, and with mm-hmm. and those were with how many different husbands?
With 3 different men.
Okay. Okay, so are those
Two.
Men still around? Or, I mean, are they in touch with you or your daughters or anything?
No.
Okay, is that good?
They're either deceased or not in touch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, two of my daughter's fathers have deceased, and the third one is not in touch.
Well, we all know that life has ups and downs. We sometimes wonder if we're ever going to get back up, because it feels like we're in a pit, right?
Oh, it's a deep, dark abyss sometimes where there's no light anywhere.
Right.
And you can't imagine how to get out of it, because there's no light and consequently no direction. So you really have to just start pushing, even though you don't know what direction to push in, or, you know, you can't see. You just have to push.
When you say push, what do you mean by push? Push against the pain, or push against the problems?
No, you don't push against the problem. You sit with the problem, and you push your way out. You push your way toward... Since I came from the light, I was blown into an abyss from a place of light. I knew it existed somewhere, even if I could not see it anywhere right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kept pushing up. And I had, like I say, no direction of which way that was.
And you've already talked about the love of your life, but as you said, how could you have known it would have a tragic ending? Tell
no
us about
way.
That. Tell us about
yeah.
what happened.
We had been married for quite a few years, coming up on our 10th anniversary. And when we met, we were in our 40s. He just was about to turn 40. I was 44. I was divorced with four young girls. He had never had any children. So that's reflective of the man he was, taking on a woman with four girls. But when I mentioned that, he got rather indignant, and so I said, "Okay, I'll never say you don't know what you're getting into again," because four girls are quite a circus at time. We became a great supporting father to them. He didn't expect to be called dad or anything like that. He was a best friend to all of us. My youngest daughter was dating this young man who had a so-called millionaire father and had been raised apparently with entitlements in replacement of human values, I suspect. They dated for about a year. She met him at her work. She was in school, and one of her college friends introduced them. Well, at school, yeah, she was working as well. They broke up. Actually, he broke up with her. He became a little abusive, obsessive, possessive, and they broke up. He wanted to get back together and became extremely obsessive, started stalking the house after she got a restraining order on him, after some physical stuff happened. He called the house like 200 times one weekend. The records were pulled later. I didn't really realize that it was that much, but it was. Anyway, she told him no, and apparently he had never been told no, because he snapped into sociopath mode and shot his way into our house with a .45 Magnum and carried a knife and bag full of reloaded bullets. And it was 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning. We were sound asleep. It was dark outside. I went out on the deck. He shot through the French door, through my chest, and proceeded to unload the gun around me, stepped in, looked right at me, and I sort of screeched, "What are you doing?" You know, because we knew the kid, and we didn't really have a volatile relationship with him. Had premonitions about, had, you know, reserves about him, but tried to be gracious parents and dissuade our daughter from hanging out with him. We didn't prohibit it, but we said, you know, "You're not a 37-year-old married woman with seven kids. You don't need this kind of stress." And so anyway, my husband was in the living room. We passed in the bedroom. He went toward him. I went toward the phone. I turned my back on him and walk away toward the phone. Called 911, heard another gunshot. I was in a full panic at that time. I could hear them rustling on the deck. All of a sudden, the phone went dead. The dispatcher was asking me where I got shot because there was so much blood coming out. I was standing in a pool, and I couldn't figure out where it was coming from because it was such a mess. He came up behind me and shot me vertically up through the back of the head. The phenomenal thing is I didn't lose consciousness at that point. I slumped onto the ground. I heard the heavy boots of the sheriffs come in the entryway, and they said, "Is anybody here?" And I weakly said, "I'm up here." And I remember the EMTs coming in with a gurney, says, "Can you get on the gurney?" And I said, "My adrenaline is so high that I could raise the roof right now," and I stood up and got on the gurney. And the story goes on from there and to the, through the hospital, the brain surgeries. I actually named him in the hallway of the hospital because one of the first investigators got in his car and drove as fast as he could an hour to the hospital because I was in the care flight. And when he asked me if I knew who, if somebody was at my house last night, I finally felt safe enough to say his name because I didn't feel safe on the phone. I was afraid he would hear me and finish me off.
So how do you, that's an incredible, I mean, that's out of the movies, you know, we're out of TV.
We
never think that could possibly
that
happen.
That's real, that, yeah. You know, that's somewhere else, some other country or some other family.
Exactly. So when you look back on all of that, obviously all the physical pain, all the emotional trauma, all the many words that we can't even come up with to describe what you were going through, how do you come out of that and move on with your life?
By staying in the now. By staying in the moment. Because despite PTSD, meltdowns, and extreme emotional trauma, I was okay right here and right now. The past was terrorizing. The immediate past was full of terror. And the future was unknown. I mean, I lost my everything in a heartbeat. I lost the love of my life. I lost us. I lost me. I came out of it paralyzed and half blind. And so the future was unknown, pretty dark. I had no idea how I was going to function by myself going forward. So I had to relearn everything, relearn how to feed myself, tie my shoes, you know, everything. But back to your question.
Yeah. How did you find the light again?
I don't know how to describe that other than I just kept pushing to get better, to get on my feet again, pushing to stand up. And one day, maybe 5 to 7 years after the incident, I woke up one day and I knew in my gut that I was out of the abyss. I knew I had hit the rim. I knew I was standing outside of the darkness. I knew I had made it out of the place that I got blown into. And it was, gratitude. Oh, my God. You know, it was the most, the hardest thing one could ever do is get through that. You know, and it's getting through it is what the recovery is. You can't get stuck in it. You can't give up. Persevere. And just have the faith that one of these days you'll get through it. You'll be out of it.
In just the time we have left, you write, "I found solace and strength in faith." Just give us some feelings as we conclude our discussion about Despite Fear, the title of your book.
Mm-hmm. Faith is not the same as beliefs. Beliefs are not always true. But having faith is abandoning your little self, your ego, your mental makeup, to something bigger, higher, and with more light and beyond yourself.
Looking and to a power that is much beyond you.
Beyond you, yes, loving something. And that was the incredible thing about my last marriage to the love of my life. I mean, it's true love when you love something more than yourself. And that was indicative of having faith, you know, in something bigger than yourself. And you have to really put your ego and your mental makeup behind the scene, on the back burner, to not let it control or take have the power. Doesn't get the power. You have to take the power away from it and give it to something higher and bigger. True power.
True power. True change.
True power. Not having anything to do with money.
Yeah. True change, true awareness to see a whole new way of thinking and living.
Right. Right.
Well, you're proof of it, Zenko, and that's what makes your book so inspiring. And for everyone, again, Despite Fear, A Visceral Plight. And we've been talking to Zenko Case. She is the author, and of course this is her journal, her memoirs, and incredible experience, and has found herself and lives in happiness and peace at this time in her life. Zenko, what's the best way to get your book?
You can go through Lulu. I have a website, and Lulu is the editor, is the Lulu Press.
What is your website?
It's Authors for, I think it's Lulu, Despite Fear.
Okay, yeah. All right.
I don't have it memorized yet.
No problem. I can edit this part out, so no problem.
Yeah, any way you search for it, it'll take you to Lulu.
Well, and of course, of all the retail outlets, online retail outlets for books.
And Amazon and IndieBooks, all those too, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Zenko. We've really appreciated the time with you, and are so thankful that you're where you are today in your life and finding peace. And we thank you for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you so much.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Lulu Publishing.
Listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up, so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Seven Rights for Citizen Slackers, with notes from the battles of Good King Boaz and the author, Dennis Boaz. He joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Lulu Publishing. Hello, Dennis.
Oh, hi, Steve.
Great to have you with us. We're going to have a lively discussion about human rights, citizen rights. You've got your very unique take on it, especially given all the following the very highly contested election and the presidential election, and you really, as you put it, you reread the Declaration of Independence, and what jumped out at you?
Well, what jumped out at me was that it was the intent of our revolutionaries to have a government whose purpose was to secure the rights of people. In fact, that's what they believed governments were. They, in the Declaration, in the second paragraph, which is where all the heavy stuff is found, it says governments are initiated to secure the rights of the people. Some other words in there, and it says, and when those rights, when a government is destructive of those rights. It's the right of the people to alter or abolish the form of government, which in this case is the Constitution. And frankly, no need to abolish the Constitution. We can amend it into any form we want to, given enough time. As long as it, to me, eventually gets back to the point that the government is established to secure the people's rights. And that didn't happen in the Constitution 11 years after the Declaration. You can look at the preamble and you can see the rights there are national rights, and the individual rights are thrown at the back of the bus. So my premise is that we got started off in the wrong foot with the Constitution, which is a document which organizes the powers of government. That's the purpose of it. And the human rights are thrown in at the end, and there are only some of those. There's some social rights, but where are the educational, cultural, safety rights? They're not there. So we didn't start our government based on human rights, and I think if we had, or if we do some point in the future, then we'll be able to achieve the purpose of government, which is to secure the rights of the people. And that's all the rights of the people. I mean, if you just secured some of the rights of the people, you'd have an imbalanced government. And that's what we have now. We just secure some of the rights of people, and so we're just limping along as a government and as a society, because those a full body of rights was never taught to us. And I believe that I discovered and developed a full, complete body of balanced and comprehensive rights that'll make the lives of people in our country and potentially everywhere better.
So do you
more remarkable?
So do you see the Democrat Party or the Republican Party really representing the people today, their rights or their desires?
No, I don't. You know, it's they're into one of the rights, and that's the rights of the people to have power. As I see it, that's one of the seven rights, and we manifest that through democracy. We don't have a representative democracy. You know, I won't insist on a pure democracy, too many people, but we don't have a meaningful representative democracy. Because we have private money and public elections, and we have an electoral college which prevents each person from having one vote. And the Electoral College, of course, is anti-democratic. We don't even have the right to democracy in the Constitution. You know, it's found in the Declaration of Independence. Eight rights are found in the Declaration of Independence, and none of those are found in the Constitution. Isn't that kind of strange? I guess they decided they couldn't really achieve the rights of the people, so why put them in the Constitution, huh?
So your title says Seven Rights for Citizen Slackers. Now, tell us about your term citizen slackers. Who are they?
Well, they're all of us, actually. They are the citizens. I mean, if government was established to secure the rights of people, why did we only have one person, Madison, who tried to tell us what our rights were? And if you look at those rights, they're mostly defenses against abuses of the British colonial government. So they're social rights in terms of how we punish people, right, and what our rights are when we're punished by a government. But there were no cultural rights. There are no educational rights. There aren't even any safety rights in there. And yet you'll find that in the Declaration of Independence, those rights. So one of my premises is we need to include all the rights of the Declaration of Independence because for some reason they were ignored. And the Ninth Amendment protects those rights because it says nothing in the enumeration of rights in the Constitution shall not be construed to demean or disparage others retained by the people. And in 1787, what rights did the people have? None other than the rights of the Declaration of Independence. And we have the right to change government according to our revolutionary founders, but when it takes two-thirds of the legislatures of the United States and then three-fourths of them are political conventions to ratify any amendments from a constitutional convention, that's hardly a right, at least in the Constitution. And yet, that's what we have to go through to amend the Constitution, because Congress is not going to amend the Constitution in any serious way. And we have several problems in the Constitution which prevent us from having a meaningful representative democracy. And so one amendment at a time won't do it. We need an Article 5 convention. And that's where the citizen slackers, that's us. Whereas if we, more of us, get involved, we can change this and establish our government so that it's more balanced, and so that the resources of government are apportioned more evenly across the board.
Well, that is the genius of our government, of citizen involvement. That is so critical, and most of us, you know, we vote, and like you point out, we pay taxes, and, you know, we, of course,
in
times of war, we go to war, and but you're saying
it's we're never fully informed. You know, that's one of the five rights. I call it the right to truth. Some people would call it the right to know. It doesn't much matter. It's also the right to justice and fairness. But unless we're informed as to what's going on, we can't do our job. And you know, I didn't put it in my book, but frankly, I could have added, I finished the book, the substance of it, November of 2014, and it wasn't crucial to me to, you know, to finish it just as the prior day's news events ended, because its premises are beyond the daily news.
So as you look at the presidential candidates that were vying to become president in this last campaign, Bernie and Hillary and Mr. Donald, any of them represent citizens?
Well, they all represent some citizens, right? I mean, Hillary won the popular election, and Donald won the election where it really counted. Again, you know, I've been harping on against the Electoral College since the 90s when I initiated a petition in Guam, which I call Guahan in deference to the Guamanians or Guahanians. They've changed the name of their island territory, but, you know, it takes a while for the cartographers to catch up. It's pretty expensive, I imagine, to change all the maps in the world for one little teeny tiny territory. But at least start that petition so they could vote in federal elections and vote for president. You know, they can't, supposedly they're Americans, but they can't vote for president, and they send their daughters and sons off and to be killed in our various conflicts, and it's unfair. And at the same time, so that the votes of Wahinians would matter, I also had that in that petition was to abolish the Electoral College so they could have a vote that was meaningful. And frankly, look at California, where I, as a Californian, voted, and the votes didn't matter, you know. I mean, we didn't get the candidates coming out here except for money and to speak with their friends who had money, but we Californians were kind of ignored in the election. But in terms of people, in terms of demographics, Bernie touched the millennials more than the other candidate. And he's very progressive, and except for his protectionism, I don't agree with the protectionism element that came into it, because that seems to fly in the face of the innovation we do in this country, which, you know, says that we need to keep our jobs as they are. Well, technology is changing things too fast. If Bernie had said, we're all entitled to a lifetime continuing education so we can keep up with technology, then I think that would have been a more improved argument rather than just a right to education at public universities. I mean, most of the important education is going to be done on the internet, and there, of course, after the internet studies and the collaboration among groups of people. But it doesn't have to be all brick and mortar education to get a good education anymore. And that's what people should have. I mean, if the people in the Rust Belt are willing to move And if they had a right to a lifetime education, they could move anywhere where jobs were needed. And if we had an educational system that taught about our whole self, the mental, physical, emotional, and the creative, we would learn about our full potentials. And that's the problem with the teaching on human rights in this country, is they're not taught as human potentials, but they're taught as how to defend ourselves against the abuses of government. That's about all students know about human rights. We realize they recognize our potential, our human potentials and our full range of human desires, then they would realize how shameful it is that we haven't gotten a full education so that we could achieve our full potentials. We are educated mostly left brain or mental and physical in school, and we ignore our emotional or psychological and our creative selves. So we get a half-brain education. So what I have here, these seven rights for seven citizens, not only applies to government, but it could be applied in, and to change government would take much longer because we have to go through an Article 5 convention. But we could be changing education now and through our charter schools and eventually to our general public schools if it were to ever catch hold. And we could change the corporate structure of our businesses by basing salaries along seven levels of consciousness or rights. I have a corporate system that reduces the difference, the wage inequality difference, and does a lot of other things for the workers that the current corporations don't do. I mean, if you base your corporations on attaining the rights of the workers and the instead of the profits of the shareholders, you really have a different outlook on business. And I believe this kind of business could outcompete typical corporations, because I think the typical corporations are too top-heavy in terms of salary to upper management.
Your education goes all the way back to the Berkeley New Age sojourn, as you put it, and back in the 70s. So a foundation was built there, as you put it,
yeah,
as you called them, ancient raw origins of a comprehensive body of rights.
Right. Well, okay. Let's start with the chakras of the Upanishads. The chakras, seven chakras, represent. I studied for a couple of years with a writer and a Hindu tantric and a philosopher, and he taught the chakras as levels of consciousness and levels of desire. And because he says that he's deceased now. He would say that everything we're conscious of, we want to have, touch, feel, love, control. In other words, we want it. We're curious about it. We want to eat outer space. We want to know about it. We want to do it. Everything that's there, we want to know something about in our reality. And so it, that's what the chakras were, or at least in the way they're modernly interpreted, is that they're levels of consciousness, and they include everything. But they're linear. I studied the Egyptian tarot, and I studied with a social anthropologist. I took 6 months of detailed instruction on the symbols of the Egyptian tarot. And that's where I learned that there are four that we are, the way the Egyptians defined us, and I agree with it, humans are fourfold. We're mental, physical, emotional, intuitive, or intuitive / creative beings. And once you establish this, it's like these four elements are the playing field of life. We do things mentally, physically, emotionally, creatively. Then you have the foundation of the four, and on top of that, you have the seven chakras, which say that mentally we have seven levels of consciousness. Physically, we have the same seven levels of consciousness. Emotionally, same seven levels. So those can be transferred into human rights, because human rights are fundamental desires. So you see there's this connection between the Hindu chakras and levels of desire or levels of human rights. And so I just, in a sense, transliterated chakras and gave them English names that we can understand as rights. And it's really a four-sided, seven-leveled organizational system that ultimately, and I have graphics in the book, that can be understood by a citizen. And once it's understood what potentials are being denied by our educational system, I think we may have a movement towards a holistic educational system instead of the half-assed educational system we now have. And I say that as a credentialed teacher, having taught for 8 years high school, as well as having been a lawyer for more than 30 years. That's where my knowledge of basic human rights and my ability to read legal documents comes from.
Well, Dennis, we appreciate you sharing about your book, Seven Rights for Citizen Slackers. Dennis Boaz is the author, and of course the publisher is Lulu. Tell us the best way to get your book, Dennis.
Amazon, Lulu, Barnes & Noble, you know, it's ebook, and I've made it very affordable. I believe I have a blueprint for societal transformation that can be very enduring. I've made it affordable on ebook. It's an affordable private. It's
right
down at the bottom for ebooks. I don't know whether I should say the price or not, but if you can't afford a paperback, then you can afford an ebook. And I think it's important to read. It will help change the perspective of citizens and get them more involved. And I frankly want all citizen slackers to become citizen partners, because I believe the social contract is no longer just between citizens and their government. I believe it's among citizens, among each other, and that we have a right and duty to secure and encourage these rights for one another. That's my philosophy.
Well, thank you, Dennis, for being with us.
You bet, Steve. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.